Well, good morning. It is somewhat of an unusual, strange even kind of gathering that we have here every first day of the week, in that the one on whom we place our focus and attention, to one to whom we give praise and thanks, the one that we celebrate, cannot be seen among us. But we do believe, because of the created world, that there is a God. We believe that because of the record that's been left in the Bible, that God had a plan that He fulfilled over centuries to send His Son. And we know, though Christ is not with us, that He is the greatest friend that we've ever had. And we come here to remember Him and to join together in fellowship with Him. And the Bible also teaches us that it is the wise person, the perceptive person, who sees that which cannot be seen with the eye. We gather here in faith. And for those who are visiting with us, we are very grateful that you've chosen to be part of our assembly. And we invite you to try to see that which you cannot see with your eye, but that which has been revealed that can be known in the world and in the Word of God, and especially the Word of God, His Son. Thank you for being here. We would love to see you back with us whenever you can assemble with us. There is a certain tact in advertising that is laced in a lot of products. And it is even used over decades in an industry that is constantly in a flux and adapting to that which is recent and modern. This is actually an approach that is, well, it's reoccurring. And that is the "you deserve it" approach to sell you an item. Whether it's fast food, cars, candy bars, expensive hair products, or resort vacations, the advertiser says to us, "You deserve this." I want to read an excerpt from an article from a financial advising website called WealthArtisan.com. It's a common sense approach to your money and investments, and it has a scathing article about this approach. But there are spiritual insights into this. The "you deserve it" marketing tactic, the article says, marketing on desires. Quote, "you deserve it" attempts to market to your desires. It attempts to throw all of your inhibitions out the window with the irrational argument of "you deserve it." When we desire something, we would love anything to have it, but that doesn't mean that we will go for it. The "you deserve it" is a way to entitle you to your desires. Regardless of what might be preventing you, this marketing tactic plays on desires. It also says, the article, is a marketing on weakness. "You deserve it" is an attempt to weaken you. Things are holding you back from purchasing, but just the right marketing attack could easily undermine the restraint. There are a number of reasons that we won't purchase something, often financial, but "you deserve it" attempts to undermine that restraint with something that transcends money or any other restraint. It says also that it's marketing on pride. The author says, "I really dislike this part of the tactic. You deserve it" attempts to market to your blind and overwhelming pride. I think that everyone has some level of pride, some more than others. And "you deserve it" attempts to play to this attribute. "You deserve it" tries to puff up your pride, and it tries to elevate the ego even higher. Worse, it implies that anyone who says otherwise doesn't find you deserving. Only the nice company and their product is on your side. Did you know that something like that happens every time we are tempted to sin? We're involved in a series of studies this spring, individual lessons through the book of James. We're entitling this series, "Where Faith Meets Life." If I believe in God, if I believe in His Son, if I believe in His Word, then how should that affect how I live? What does a lived faith look like? This is what the book of James is answering. The book of James is about taking your faith out of the laboratory, out of the classroom, and putting it in the real world. And when it's there, what does it do? What impact does it have? How does it shape us and how does it direct us? And this morning, I want us to look at this matter. Our temptations versus God's blessings. And I want you to note, though we'll draw the contrast toward the end, that this text is a contrast text. You may recall that last time we studied, we ended with verse 12, which says in James 1, "Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life which God has promised to those who love him." The beginning of the book of James is about trials or tests of our faith. It's where we face things in life that challenge us to hang on to our faith. And this is talking about the blessing upon those who will endure that trial. Well, we all know that oftentimes when we go through a period of tests and trials, there can also be within those or leading from those temptations. So this brings us to chapter 1, verse 13 to 18. Read that with me. "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am being tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruit of his creatures." I want you to consider with me this morning, first of all, how that this text is broken into two parts. And the first one deals with the temptations that we face, the temptations within. Temptation here, used in James 1 and elsewhere in the Bible in most contexts, is talking about when we're enticed to sin, to do wrong, to transgress God's word, to rebel against God's will in our life. In this text, first of all, identifies two things. First of all, that temptation is not sin. Note the progression in the text, that temptation occurs. And why it occurs, as we'll explore in a moment, but eventually the temptation can lead to sin. But note that also, that sin is a process. Sin is rarely a moment of time kind of thing. If we think that sin is all about just all of a sudden being blasted out of the blue, blindsided, and then we just cave in out of weakness or because we're not expecting it, we have the wrong view of sin. It's not James' view. Sin is a process. Verse 15 talks about when it has the desire conceived, gives birth, and then is fully grown. The analogy there is of a living being, whether it be an animal or a human being, that is conceived and then is born, and then grows. Sin is a process. Let's look at that process. One common but very dangerous thought is that somehow temptation, directly or indirectly, is coming from God. We see this in the very first sin. Go back with me to Genesis chapter 3. In Genesis 2, humans were told that they have this whole garden full of trees, Genesis 1 and 2, to eat from. But God gave a prohibition. In Genesis 2, he said, "You shall not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, or you'll die." And then the serpent comes and tempts Eve. And then she gives it to her husband, and the human sin. And when God comes to confront them, we read in Genesis 3, verse 11, he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" The man said, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me fruit of the tree and I ate. What is Adam's explanation for his sin? The woman you gave me, God. James says, when you're tempted, do not say, I'm tempted of God. Exactly what Adam said. Verse 13 says, the Lord said to the woman, what is it that you've done? The woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. It's one of these other creatures that's in the garden where I'm living, where you put me. It's my circumstances and who's around me. We must guard against similar lines of thinking. Thinking that says something like, well, God put me in this world around so many wicked people. What can I do but to be affected by them? God made my mind this way or my body this way. I can't help it that I sin. God has put me in this pressure situation or given me these burdens to carry. And thus, He's the one tempting me. Whether we state it or not, whether we think it plainly and overtly or subtly, subconsciously, this is a common thing that humans can do. James is very clear in his teaching. God, because of His very nature, is not attracted to anything evil. And that's what you've got to do. James is pulling everybody back to the big picture here and to the weight of the evidence. And if you pull back here, it doesn't make any sense that God is trying to get us to sin. God hates sin. It's against His very nature. He cannot be enticed to pursue it. He does not want anybody else to pursue it. And the very fact that the sending, as we've commemorated today, the sending of His Son out of great sacrifice to come and live on earth and to die on the cross as culmination of His great plan to save us from sin, that is evidence enough to understand God's relationship to sin and how He wants us free from it. It does not make any sense at all that He would sacrifice His Son to free us from sin and then on the other hand try to get us in it. It's not logical, is it? There is a biblical caveat. And that is, wicked people bent on rebellion that you read about in the Bible are sometimes referred to as being affected by God in the sense that God allows them to continue on their path, and even the way He orchestrates events leads to their fulfillment of their sin. For instance, Pharaoh, who from the get-go, though he was told to release the Israelites, would not. And in spite of the plague after plague after plague that devastated his land, he continued, as the text says in Exodus, to harden his heart, though other texts say that after God would do something, God hardened Pharaoh's heart. You cannot isolate those kinds of statements and conclude that God is some tempter of evil, but rather God's action hardened the ruler's stubbornness that was already there. Instead of the miracles, the plagues bringing Pharaoh around, it pushed Pharaoh further away. I mean, if you think about the evil actors involved in the crucifixion, we see that God saw it ahead of time. There are prophecies in the Old Testament about some of the evil actors involved in the death of Jesus. But God did not make those people do that. He did not entice them to do that. God, in His infinite wisdom and foreknowledge, saw ahead what people would do, and He used their choices and orchestrated those events. In His judgment, God orchestrates things to allow a person's rebellion to continue. He does not force us to stop sinning, but indeed, He does not force us to sin or even entice us to sin. It's not what He's about. So where do temptations come from? Well, according to this reading in James 1, they come from within. I know it's easy for us to think, well, what about, you know, people who do this and people who do that and worldly influences? And there is a sermon to be preached about influences outside of us that entice us to do evil. But I think James is getting at the core of what's going on here. I think this is the real heart of understanding temptation. James says that it starts with our selfish, our sinful desires. He says in verse 14 there, but each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Some translations say by his own lusts. Some say his evil desires. What are we talking about here? By his own desires. This is not talking about natural desires, like the physical desire for food or water, or the social emotional desire for friendship and love that we have as human beings. No, when you see such expressions used, each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire, and then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. What the Bible is talking about here in these situations indicates something that is coming from our selfishness. Not from our natural human state, but rather from our chosen disposition about ourselves and about others and about the world. Disposition of selfishness. One of the best ways to interpret the book of James is with the book of James. And here's what I mean by that. It has a cyclical nature to it. It brings up some of the same themes and concepts, but it approaches them from a different angle to shed more light on them. Look at another place when he's talking about temptation and sin and the root of it. Look with me in James chapter 4. James 4 says in verse 1, what causes quarrels and what causes fights among you? Is it not this, that your passions are at war within you? You desire and do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Start at the end there, and that is the person who is manifesting this kind of attitude and behavior is an enemy of God. So remember that. It's the opposite of God. It's contrary to God. But did you know what was happening there? He describes some very disturbing behaviors. Murdering, fighting, quarreling. Why? Because they had passions and desires. They had wants. But these things are depicted here as being amiss, as being selfish. These are desires or lusts that are coming out of a selfishness inside of us. He talks about covet, fighting, quarreling, asking wrongly. All of this has to do with wanting what you want with no consideration of anything or anybody else. Take with me the temptation to steal something. The Bible teaches us to work and to earn a living, to provide for our needs. But here comes a person into a store, and they have no consideration that some group of people or some person has taken their own money and invested in the products of the store, sometimes at great risk and sacrifice. People have worked long hours setting things up. People are depending on a profit to pay others. And the person who comes in and steals from the store has no consideration for anybody else. It even impacts other customers because when stealing is rampant, there has to be more security and measures in place, and thus it runs up the prices of all the goods in the store. It's completely no regard for anybody else when a person steals in a store. Somebody may think, well, you know, other people, you know, they've had the breaks, and I've not had the breaks. I've had to do this, and I've had to do that, and I want this, and I want that. You see the selfishness in that. And even selfishness can manifest out of proper and natural desires. For instance, the sexual desire. We're involved in this marriage study on Sunday mornings right now. And if you were in Rick's class this morning, one of the takeaways you got from that is that you've got to be a reasonable, fair, and unselfish person to be a good mate. Marriage is God's realm for sexual activity. But to be in the marriage realm, to be married, means that you've got to have a partner. And there's a give and take. And there's a sharing. It requires unselfishness to make a marriage work. Sexual activity outside of marriage requires no unselfishness. And in a way, you could say, by definition, it's selfishness. It's a selfish act or selfish behavior. There's the idea of becoming bitter and angry and retaliating and taking revenge on people. One may understand that there is a right and a wrong, and there's a right way to treat people and a wrong way to treat people, and one may have a sense of justice. And one may even have an awareness that, well, though someone may wrong another, vengeance is not a good idea. And of course, the Bible teaches against it. But here's a person when they're mistreated. And then all of a sudden, they take it so personally. They become super sensitive about it, how they're treated. And as the selfishness wells up, then they lash out. They say things they ought not say. They zap back at the person. They take vengeance. Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. And it says, by his own desire. That means a personal thing. Not somebody else's. It's his or hers. You could also see this, and I think this is, you see this in examples off of the Bible, that it's a selfish desire unique to that person. What tempts one person may not tempt another person, and vice versa. Because we're all selfish in different ways. We all have different selfish sensitivities. We all have different selfish ambitions. We all have different selfish desires. And we really understand that this is the root cause of sin. When we look at this, when it says where a person is tempted when he's lured and enticed by his own desires, selfishness, we really understand that sin results from being tempted to act out of selfish desire when we consider the one who withstood all temptation. When we consider the one that, though he was tempted as we are, was without sin. Consider with me what is said about Jesus in Philippians 2 as a model. In Philippians, the second chapter, verse 3, Paul's admonition here to the Philippian Christians is, in Philippians 2, verse 3, do nothing from selfish ambition or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look out not only to his own interest, but also to the interests of others. Paul is teaching here, as a Christian, you need to be unselfish. And then he gives the example of all examples. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus. There he links what should be in your mind. Oh, did you see that? See the idea of temptation within? Have this mind inside of you, and he pairs it with the mind of Christ. Who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. Do you see the opposite? The fact that Christ had regard for us. That he was not just thinking about and operating from the premise of what was good for him and what he wanted, but other people. That is at the core of who he was and what led him to the cross, his great act. So that's the opposite, isn't it? Christ is the opposite of sin. He's got the opposite mind that would lead one into sin. And what was that mind? Unselfishness. To withstand temptation means to think oneself out of selfishness. This is a crucial moment when we're tempted. To think ourselves out of the selfishness that is kicking in. Because that's the root. Because when we think selfishly and then act selfishly, we sin one way or the other somehow. That's where it leads. He talks about here in this process of being lured and enticed in James 1. These are terms that are similar to the ideas of a hook that's used to catch a fish or a snare for an animal. What do you think of an animal or a fish that's caught? Caught with bait, caught by a hook, caught in a trap. Do you think of how the animal is inferior and that human being is an advanced creature and can catch a fish like that or a bear like that or a raccoon or whatever? Do we think that they're lacking in intelligence? And those are true points. Those are true points. I mean, look at some animal traps and you're like, I don't see how they don't get this. Okay? I don't see why they don't see the problem here. Okay? But here's what happens when an animal or a fish is taken in a trap. They think they see one thing, but it's really another. They see the worm, not the hook. Threaded through the worm. They see the raw meat under the trap. They don't really look at the trap above it. And we do the same thing. When we do not check our selfish desires, we set ourselves up to be trapped and captured by sin. Think about this. Somebody who wants a car, and they want a certain kind of car, and they dream of that car. It's like this latest car with this new, streamlined design and this incredible color and gadgets. And it's just the thing that all the movie stars drive on television. And it's instant cool maker right there. You drive that car and you're instantly it kind of thing. And they go to the lot to buy this car. The truth is, it's a lemon. And there's something rational within the person that says, well, this is a whole lot of money for a car. And this car just came out. It's sort of some of these new features are not proven yet. And the person begins to think, I've heard some shady things about this dealership. But then the person looks at the car and they think, look at that color. It is Midnight Majestic Blue or something. They have these names they make up. They make up these names, They make them up. Just make them up. And the person thinks, wow, every head will turn if I drive down the road in this car. Toward me, by the way. I will just be so something if I'm driving down the road in this car. And then the person begins to think, well, Sammy Smiley here, he looks like he can be trusted. See what's happening? The desire for the car changes our thinking. Our rationale is changed by our desire. That's where the lurement and enticement occurs. I want you to look at a couple passages. There was one that Rick used this morning. But look at this one before we look at that one. Back in the Proverbs. In Proverbs 9. In the book of Proverbs, though, it has such a wide array of application. Initially, the book of Proverbs was written to a young man to make him wise and not foolish. And here is a foolish young man that is depicted in Proverbs 9. Proverbs 9, beginning in verse 13. The woman's folly is loud. So folly or foolishness is personified by a woman here. And it's not just any woman, it's the seductress. She is seductive and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house. She takes the seat on the highest places of the town, calling to those who pass by who are going straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks sense, she says, stolen water is sweet and bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there, and that her guests are in the depths of Sheol, which is the grave. Now, it definitely has a sexual application here, and there are other passages that plainly talk about that. But this would involve sexual temptation, but it's period. foolishness really does the sales job. Makes itself presentable and pretty and out there. And foolishness says to the simple person, turn in here, what I've got to offer you is great. And he just doesn't look at what he needs to look at. And he buys into it because he has these desires. And the next thing you know, he's in a death trap. The 1 Timothy 6 passage about money. Turn over there to the New Testament in 1 Timothy 6 and look at the same idea again. It starts with own desire and lured and enticed and even where it leads. 1 Timothy 6 says in verse 6, "But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world and we cannot take anything out of the world. But we have food and clothing, with these we'll be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs." I mean, why is it that very smart people, very accomplished people, get caught embezzling funds and cooking the books? Because they have a desire to be prominent like a rich person, or to have certain things that a rich person can have, that Rolex or that car or that house or that vacation. And that desire leads them into behaviors that if they were thinking rationally, they would realize this is wrong, this is bad, this is destructive, but that desire blinds them and they walk right into a destructive trap. The deceit occurs when we shift our thinking to justify the feelings or the actions. The desire is so strong that we begin to think things like, well, it's not that wrong after all. It's not as bad as what some other people do. Or, I've had such a hard time. In other words, I deserve it. I deserve this. Or even thinking along the lines of, well, that person had it coming to them. Maybe I shouldn't have said this, I shouldn't have said that. Well, that person had it coming to them. Our desire out of selfishness begins to justify and excuse the sin. We've got to watch our selfish desires. Our selfish desires for things, for pleasure, for position. Our desires to be important. Our desires to be recognized. Our desires to be adored. And even our desires to punish other people for insulting or hurting us. To get back at other people for doing things against us. Because it's when the selfish desire is not checked, our thinking gets twisted. And we deceive ourselves. We step into a trap. Because look what James says it results in. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. We're tempted to just start defining death, right? Well, what kind of death is it? Every time you sin, you die? Well, wasn't that the mistake that Adam and Eve made? Satan said to Eve, "You're not going to die." And she ate it. And if they're thinking like, their heart's going to stop and they're going to fall over, that didn't happen. This is a big picture. This is destruction. And yes, there's a physical element to it, but it's mostly a spiritual element. It's mostly what is destroyed is our trueness of what we can be, what God intended for us to be. It's a destruction of our soul before God. To sin, to rebel against God and transgress His will is sort of an insane act. It's as if God's not going to see this, or God's not going to notice, or God's not going to care. It's sort of insane to think that. But we become blind to how bad and wrong and dangerous and destructive something is because we're thinking and acting selfishly, and that's where we become lured and hooked. And we may be enticed by outside influences, bad examples, and people trying to get us to do this and go here and be involved in that, and people fueling our bitterness and jealousy. I can't believe you let him get away with that. And you hear what they said to you, what they said about you the other day, and people. And it's true; these outside influences are strong, and Jesus talks about them, about those who are stumbling blocks and so forth. But that's not really where the battle's won. Because we know Jesus lived in that world too, you know. But when we allow those outside influences to play upon our selfishness, our selfish desires, our desire for self-preservation, for self-promotion, for self-elevation, then that's when those outside influences take us down. You know, it's like a horror movie or a science fiction movie or a horror science fiction movie. That's not really my favorite genres, by the way. But I know there's some like this that have this kind of motif in them, is where there's some kind of creature inside somebody. They've been in, you know, some kind of alien put a bug in them or something. And all of a sudden, it just comes out. And it destroys the person, destroys everybody around it. Our selfishness becomes sin, which is the monster that comes from within us out, and it does all this, this deadly destruction. And so the work we've got to do and the fight that we've got to fight is with these selfish desires within that breed envy and anger and lust and covetousness. But James is not through here. We're not just left with, don't let this happen. But Brother James is also giving us what can happen. The good alternative here. In verse 13 of James 1, James says there, as he begins that section, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God. And then he explains that. And then what does he do? In verse 16, he says, don't be deceived, my beloved brothers. Get your thinking right. Don't look at the wrong thing. Don't think that it's this and when it's really that. Don't be fooled here. Don't think God is the one tempting you. The truth is, God is the one blessing you. And thus he says, starting in verse 17, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. It's easy to believe the lie that God is working against us, when in fact, what this is telling us is one that the main reason why you do not have to give in to your selfish desires is that whatever you need, whatever is good for you, whatever is going to help you, God is the one who's going to give that to you. It's a fascinating expression here that is used. Father of light. It was a common Jewish expression for God, found in and outside of biblical literature. James is writing to a group of Christians of a Jewish background. And he calls God Father of Lights. Well, think with me for a moment. What are the lights? Well, Genesis 1, the first book in the Hebrew Bible, tells us what the lights are. The sun, the moon, the stars, the heavenly bodies. But think about those lights. The original lights. The great lights. What happens to those lights? They change. They vary. We've got sun right now, but in about 8 hours, we won't be able to see it. Won't be around for hours. I don't know if there's a full moon tonight or a half moon, quarter moon, or whatever, but sometimes at night you see the moon, but then there are certain times of the month you don't see the moon at night. And then, of course, in the daytime you don't see the moon, except some variations in the morning and the evenings you occasionally see it, but you typically don't see, and you don't typically see stars in the daytime. And then there are sometimes when there is cloud cover and you don't see the sun or the moon or the stars or anything day or night. But these gifts come down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. God is the constant light. He shines His light of blessing on us constantly, consistently, faithfully. God gives good gifts and perfect gifts. He doesn't give temptations. Now, we may think, well, don't we go through difficult times in life? And, well, yeah, He just talked about that at the beginning of the chapter. But these aren't curses. Trials can solidify our faith and bring us closer to God. Even they aren't working against us if we only would draw near God. You see, seeing God's faithfulness to us, seeing that He's for us, and seeing that He has blessed us and appreciating those gifts, that's the greatest antidote to temptation. We are tempted when within our selfishness, we think, well, I want this and I'm not getting that, and this would be good for me, and I want this and I want that. And we're just missing what God has done, what God is doing, what God will do, and how that God's blessings are better than anything else. We blind ourselves to that, and then we fall into sin. It's like sitting at a dinner table where there's a bunch of really aggressive, hungry people, and there are all these adults around, and the plates are set on the table, and people start diving in with forks and grabbing things and snatching things, and then there's this little baby sitting in a high chair. That little baby just has to sit there and wait. The baby doesn't have the ability, can't reach out and grab the chicken. If that baby has a faithful parent, the baby's going to be fed and cared for. We've got a faithful Father. He's the Father of lights, in whom there is no variation or shadow. You see, we are depicted as being dependent and should be dependent. That passage again over in James 4, using James to understand James, after that section about, you know, you want and you lust and you don't have because you ask wrongly to spend it on your passions. Down later in that reading, he says in verse 6, but He gives more grace. Therefore it says, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. Submit yourselves therefore to God. It's the depiction of dependence, isn't it? Humble dependence. And look at this contrast here that's showing that blessings come from God, not temptations. Look at this contrast. It's quite marvelous the way these words are used here. In verse 14, but each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Each person is tempted by his own desire. When we act out of selfishness, we become this slave to selfishness, and we are totally dependent on whatever our selfishness gives us. Whatever we can grab and attain and fight for and steal, and that's what we get. But then verse 18 says, of His own will He brought us forth by the word of truth. Do you see that contrast? There's our will. There's our selfish desire, our own desire, and then there is His own will. Do you see the difference? Which is it going to be? Are we going to live by our own desire or His own will? And then he talks there in verse 15 about how that when we are enticed and lured by our own desires, then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. Look at the contrast in verse 18. Of His own will He brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of His creatures. Wow, there's another birth. Before the birth is our sin that comes out of our selfishness. And our selfishness leads us to be tempted, which then is born out our sin that leads to our death. The contrast of that is if we submit to His own will, He produces something within us that's new. We become this new creature. We become like this first fruit of God. We become His children. See, we can choose not to trust God, not to see His blessings, and just grab everything we can get. Whoever gets in the way, any rule can be broken. It doesn't matter. Everything that's in reach, we act out of self-preservation, self-defense, self-centeredness, self-promotion. And sometimes this is just blatantly promoted in our culture. If you want something, you got to go get it. If you want something, don't let anybody get in your way. You go for it. In a sense that is fueling self-centeredness, self-promotion. And this leads to sin, which leads to our death and destruction. We can choose to grab everything selfishly, or we can trust God, be guided by His own will, not our selfish will, accept His blessings, and become His creatures, His new creatures, His people. It's somewhat of a simple kind of premise. We can trust God and be guided by His will, not our own selfish will, and accept His blessings and become His creatures and people, or we can be on our own and fight out of our selfishness to get things. How will that end? It's always better to depend upon God than to selfishly grab. In the end, we'll be richly blessed for it. And here is this odd paradox about human life. The more you want selfishly and try to grab it, the less you'll get. And the more you just trust God and depend upon Him and act out of service to Him rather than selfishness, the richer you'll become. Take a hospital. A hospital is a controlled place. Most people just can't go just anywhere in a hospital. They've got signs up and locks, and you got to swipe a badge, and if you're back in there and you're not supposed to be at a certain time or back there at all. And then the ones where I really walk on the other side of the hall where they show that radiation sign, whatever's going on in there, I don't want a part of that. And it's got controlled substances within it. There are medicines. Those medicines are monitored. Those medicines are, there's records with those medicines. Those medicines are kept behind lock and key. And there's controlled equipment. You just can't come up and start working with an X-ray or an MRI or this kind of probe or whatever. I mean, you've got to be a tech. You've got to be trained on it. What if you're hurting or you're sick? And so you just dash into the hospital. And you just start grabbing stuff and swallowing it and injecting it. And you get under that machine and flip it on. And you crawl in that machine and you flip it on. And you grab that mask and breathe for a while. You're going to fix yourself. What's likely to be the result? Probably won't get any better. Truth is, you'll probably get worse. You know what we do? We find a trustworthy, proven doctor that's been legitimized. We find a staff that is qualified. We find a reliable facility. And we go in and we lay down and let them do what they need to do to help us. We even have to take our clothes off and put those gowns on. I mean, it is a very dependent sick. Now you got to go over here now. Now you got to go over here and sit. Now you got to go over here and lie down. Now you got to go over here and hold your breath for 5 seconds. Now you got to go over here and do this. You're completely dependent. That's how you get better. That's how you get the treatment that you need. Sin is selfishly trying to fix ourselves and fill ourselves up. That's when we unselfishly trust God to do that. that we'll receive the real good and perfect gifts from above that eternally satisfy. Well, Brother Charles is going to lead us in another hymn that will encourage us and prompt all of us to think about our souls before God. And if you are ready to answer the call of the gospel, that you believe that Jesus is the Christ and you're willing to confess that, knowing that He's died for you and you want to live for Him, then today, out of your repentant heart, you can be baptized into Christ and begin to live a free life, free from self, and live for God in Christ, which is so much richer. If you're prepared to make that commitment and walk that way, then once you come together, we stand and sing.
As I travel through this pilgrim land, there is a friend who walks with me. Thank you.